Chatter on Books. It's Cliff Notes for book clubs. Why read the book if you can listen to Chatter on Books? I'm Jamie McIntyre, your announcer, but you don't care about that. Here again is your host, Tori Clark.
Hey, thanks, Claude. Welcome back, everybody, to Chatter on Books. I hope you're all doing well and staying healthy and staying cool. Whatever part of the world you're in, it's really hot in your nation's capital today. It is very hot. In just a little bit, we are going to be talking to one of my favorite new authors, Maroa Yejide. And she's a DC native. I got to talk with her during the Gaithersburg Book Festival, which is all virtual this year. She has this marvelous, marvelous, truly magical book called Creatures of Passage. And she's just a wonderful person. So we'll be talking to her. In the meantime, Claude Jennings, who just disappeared from my screen. I always get nervous when Claude does that. is he still there? Is he still recording? There he is. Claude Jennings doing the important work. David Aldridge looking very sporty in his baseball jersey this evening, for those of you who can't see this. And Ron Charles, Washington Post book critic, coming back. Hi, Ron. Welcome back.
Oh, it's great to be back. Thank you for asking me.
I'm watching you. You know, most people can't see you, but we can see you. Have you had your Zoom room rated? Have you been in that website yet?
I think somebody did recently. I was doing one for maybe a pre-interview for the Library of Congress, but I don't use this background when I'm being seen. I use more of a bookie background like that. So,
do you change the books on your bookcase back there?
I do sometimes, depending on who I'm interviewing. Yeah, like I'll put all their books there or books about that subject there. Yeah.
So David and Claude know this. I usually have a bookcase behind me, which is primarily books of authors that have been on Chatter on Books.
Nice.
And I won't say who until the last episode of this show, and we'll have a lot of drinks, and I'll say which person complained about where his or her book was on the show,
placement.
And next to whose. They were not happy about that.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we talk about so many things on the show other than books, and we're going to start with something today. How about the news of Jeff Bezos saying he's going to go to space with his brother?
How about that? Yeah.
That is wild. I wish he wouldn't. I want him to stay around for a very long time, and that seems dangerous to me.
Yes, full disclosure, he's kind of your boss, right, Ron?
He owns the Washington Post, yes. He is not my boss.
I wonder what kind of insurance or what kind of waiver he has to sign.
A really big one from Lloyd's. Is Lloyd's of London still in business? I don't know if they still work or not.
Well, ransomware got them. Ransomware got Lloyd's.
So
July 20th, he and his brother, who he claims is his best friend, and somebody who's winning, they have an auction. They say they're going to have an auction for another seat on this spaceship. And so far, the bidding is up to about $3 million. And if somebody has $3 million to spend on this, they've got too much money. But they're going to go 60 miles into outer space. So would you do it? Ron Charles, would you do it?
Definitely not.
Definitely not. David?
I would not go on a Jeff Bezos rocket, no.
Go on somebody's rocket.
I would go on a NASA rocket if it was NASA and they spent 10 years, you know, working on it like they used to back in the good old days.
Like the Challenger?
Ouch.
Ouch.
Ouch. It was only once.
Too soon. Come on, dude.
Maybe twice. Yeah. Would you go to the moon, David?
I'm not averse to the idea. I would not mind if it was with people that knew what they were doing. Yeah.
And if you could know somebody new, you wouldn't want to go alone.
No. I'd have to go with other people. I wouldn't want to go by myself. No. But, you know, a mission with like six or seven people.
Yeah.
If I were somehow smart enough to be on that ship with them, which is not going to happen in this lifetime.
What do we think Elon Musk will do now? Because he said he plans to go to space or something because he's got his space company. Jeff Bezos has his space company.
He'll go to, you know, he'll find a new planet, discover a new planet, and then say he's going there.
Make a new planet.
Jeff Bezos.
Exactly. Yeah. Have you guys heard that joke about, I guess Bezos is building a $500 million super yacht?
I did hear about the super yacht, yes.
Yeah, he's building a super yacht. And so the joke is that Elon Musk is going to build a $600 million iceberg. So spectacular.
The super yacht even has, I hear, a little yacht that takes people to it.
That is so funny.
Just incredible. And it's bigger. It's longer than a football field and all those things, right?
Yeah. It's.
Yeah, you need something smaller because you can only go into so many ports if you're that big.
Right. And we're still waiting for him to move into the house here. You know, he bought the old textile museum and turned it back into a house.
But well, you've been invited to the open house?
I have not been invited yet. I'm sure it was lost in the mail. Yeah. I don't think it's opened yet. I think the pandemic.
Because you don't refer to him as your boss.
Yeah. If you got invited to Jeff Bezos's open house, what would you take as a housewarming gift?
Maybe a panda. I don't know. What would one take?
small token of my esteem, Mr. Bezos.
A Hope Diamond? I don't know.
Okay, that joke makes me think, though, of the Titanic. Have you guys seen the it was a segment on Saturday Night Live a few weeks ago in which one of the comedians, the young Asian comedian, was the iceberg from the
Yeah, that was funny. He's very funny. Bowen Yang, I believe is his name. He's very funny.
What's his name again, David?
It's Bowen Yang. I hope I'm saying that right.
Okay, well, however
he's
we
very
say
funny.
It.
Yes, he was the iceberg. Yes.
One of the cleverest things I've seen on Saturday Night Live in a long time.
Yes.
Okay, we have one email, and then I've got a couple questions probably for Vaughn.
From our fan.
From our fan.
That's what we used to say. One letter poured in.
The guys on Smartless, Bateman and Sean Hayes and Will Arnett always talk about listener in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Listener as in singular. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We've got at least six.
Yeah.
Six. Okay. But this is from Dave. I think Dave may have emailed us before and he got a big kick out of it. Hey, Tori and the gang, how great is Anne? That's Anne Hornaday, who we had on a couple weeks ago.
Love Anne. Yep.
She's spectacular.
Very good.
So smart, so thoughtful, terrific listener. We had on this guy, Edward White, Ron, that wrote this great book about Alfred Hitchcock, The 12 Lives of Alfred Hitchcock.
Yeah, I sent that to my mom.
Very clever the way he wrote it. And what's interesting, I don't know if David has an opinion on this, but we love and adore Anne Hornaday. She's on Tony's show all the time. I think she's better on this show than she is on Tony's show.
Oh, interesting.
Everybody's
okay. Anyway, he loves Anne. We all love Anne.
Kids, because I love.
Please know that your last episodes were fantastic. Just read Outlawed, and I think we had Anna North on Ron because you guys had reviewed Outlawed, and
Great book.
And listened again to the podcast after I read it. I think I'm going to read the other book that she wrote next time, The Life and Death of Sophie Stark. Can't thank you enough for being our book club. So sorry about your Washington Ovechkins bowing out in the first round again, David.
Ah, yes.
It was sad. David, I'm very worried about the Caps next year.
You should be.
They're not any younger. They're not.
No, they're not.
Any
it's,
younger.
It's a young man's sport, and they're not young. So.
All right, Ron Charles, I've got a couple questions about bestseller lists.
Oh, yes. Go ahead. I'll do my best.
They're all different. Washington Post, New York Times. They're different.
Yes.
How do the people who put those lists together try to prevent people from gaming the system? And not that I'm going to name them, but I know several people, none of whom I like, who found ways to do bulk purchases of their books.
Yes, this happens once a year at least. Somebody gets exposed for this. well, the Times does it by keeping the reporting stores secret, so you don't know which stores are reporting. Mm-hmm. The other people that compile lists look for unusual behavior, like if 600 copies sell in a bookstore in Atlanta, something's up there. But it could be something very legitimate, like somebody's giving a lecture, and so everyone that coming to the lecture buys their book. So it doesn't have to be nefarious necessarily.
Right.
But they do look for unusual patterns of buying or bulk purchases in specific areas.
And is it still counting up books sold in bookstores? What about submitted in much feared Amazon?
Amazon doesn't report its figures to anyone else, but it has its own bestseller list, and you can see what's happening there. Yes.
Hmm.
But you've got the big boxes, too. You know, Target and Walmart move a lot of books, so they get a pretty representative list of what's happening.
Yeah.
The lists are all being edited, though, to make them interesting to particular audiences. I think USA Today's list is just the best-selling books, but other lists are designed in certain ways, you know, just literary fiction. And so you remove certain kinds of genre fiction, maybe textbooks never show up. All kinds of books never show up. Amazon includes some of their own proprietary books that don't show up in other lists. Uh-huh. The Times famously started a children's list so they could get Harry Potter off the bestseller list because it was crowding out all the adult books.
Right.
20 years ago. So the lists are all massaged in certain ways, but I don't think for any, you know, not for any secret or illegal reasons. It's just to make them more interesting and to get them to shift. We just shifted recently to the indie bookstore bestseller list, which I like because indie bookstore people, you know, have fairly sophisticated tastes, and it's an interesting list, I think. But it doesn't differ that much from the other lists.
I want a niche that is books that were never edited because your editor was Dominic Anfuso and he never edited the book. Because on that, I would be. Okay, I have a question, a very specific question about Where the Crawdads Sing.
Wow.
Yeah. Look at every list, and it was a fabulous book by Delia Owens. it just keeps showing up and showing up and showing up. And it's kind of an odd book. It's about this feral child gets wrapped up in a horrible murder accusation, but it's wonderful. But Ron, what is it that causes a book to just keep showing up? And has anybody ever done the demographics? Because it can't be just one small segment of society that likes a book to carry it this long.
No. And when you think of what that means, not just that it sold more than 5 million copies, but that it sells a lot of copies every week, new readers every single week. Because to stay on the bestseller list, you can't just sell 10 million copies in 1 month. You have to keep selling books. And I keep wondering, here we are, you know, it came out in August 2018. So we're almost at 3 years now. It's still number five on our paperback bestseller list. Who are the new readers who are discovering this book? Who's left?
And I thought they were all busy watching Mayor of Easttown. So how do people have time to read this? It's remarkable.
Just wait, because Reese Witherspoon, you know, is filming it right now with her production company. And when that movie comes out, you know, we're going to have it's going to be back up at number one for months.
It's very cool. Who's winning the Michelle Obama versus Barack Obama memoir race?
Oh, interesting. I'm almost positive it's Michelle.
Oh, she's crushing, right?
Yeah.
I don't think it's close.
Did you ever read that? Have we talked about that, Ron? Did you ever read hers?
I have not read it. No.
It's wonderful.
That's what I've heard.
And I found myself once a month, maybe a little bit less, I'll find myself getting it for someone and say, no, you should read this. I hear them, Barack Obama, God bless him. David and I have talked about this a lot. Big political figures usually write their memoirs very defensively, right? Very defensively, and to correct every allegation they never liked, et cetera. Hers is not a political memoir. Hers is a really interesting 21st century woman talking about what it's like to be a 21st century woman in a very challenging marriage and sacrifices that she had to make. I thought it was great.
Nice. I just so happened to be reading President Obama.
You started reading it. What do you think?
It's written by a former president of the United States. And it reads like one. You know, it's fine, but it's funny. I think what President Obama thinks is candor is not what I would consider candor. You know, that's okay. He's a, you know, private person and very, you know, there's things that I would really like to know about him that I don't think he's ever going to tell anybody.
Yeah. Interesting. I think he's doing an interview with Anderson Cooper tonight. He's starting to come out a little bit more.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very
kind. I've only just started it. I'm only about 50 pages in, but you know, reads like the book of a former president.
So this is the first of three in his memoirs, right, Ron? Isn't this the first volume?
I thought it was two, but is it three?
I don't know. You know, Holy Trinity is what I was thinking. David, will you buy the next one? Will you read the next one?
This was a gift. So it was my wife gave it to me. It's going to depend on how the rest of the book reads, you know, by the way, Ron, I guess Bill Clinton's not going to be coming to your cocktail.
Yeah. I think I'm off the Christmas list.
Explain, David.
Wow.
To our listener in Wisconsin, explain.
The former president wrote another book with James Patterson. That's correct, right?
Yes.
And, you know, it has to get reviewed by somebody. And old Ron decided to review it yesterday and, you know, went Al Capone on his ass. Outstanding.
Have you gotten any hate mail yet, Ron?
What's that?
Have you gotten any hate mail yet?
My voice emails. Yeah. Clinton fans have come after me. Why do I hate the Clintons so much? Why can't I let go?
When he works with someone like James Patterson, I saw them do some interviews. Does James Patterson really do the writing?
That is the abiding mystery. Clearly, James Patterson. And does James Patterson do his own writing? I mean, he has a team of people doing his writing. So yeah. I don't know. It's a very complicated arrangement. I think I know Patterson outlines the plots. I know he oversees things. But does he actually do the writing? I really don't know.
Yeah. It's like Tom Clancy. He wrote the first few and they're great. And then he starts bringing in people to work with them and it becomes more and more derivative where you almost.
Franchise. Yeah.
Yeah. Franchise. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. That's cool. All right, Ron, tell us what we should be reading this summer and what.
We published a list of 20 books for the summer. I won't go through all 20, but a bunch of fun stuff on there. Fun. And I should say not all fun. Some of it's very, very serious, but I would recommend Black Buck by Matea Askapor. Really funny office satire about a young black man who gets hired in a startup firm. And it's just a great bit of parody about the post-racial office. I thought it was incredibly witty. This is a new young writer, and I think he's just great. Jenny Lawson, you'll remember, she's a very funny comic writer, writes about her own life. She's everything about her is weird and funny. She's got a book out called Broken in the Best Possible Way. Not funny at all. Patrick Keefe's got a new book called Empire of Pain. This is his investigation of the Sackler family, OxyContin, the opioid epidemic. It is just one horrible, ghastly, shocking anecdote after another about this family and their industry.
Is it? I've read so much about that book, or it seems like for months and months and months and months, we've been hearing about that book coming out and looking at the Sacklers. Is it worth reading, or is it just so depressing? What is it that would make David put down the Barack Obama memoir and pick it up?
It is shocking. I mean, no matter how much you've read the details of this industry, of its effect on the country, it's just, I mean, it is depressing. You're certainly right. It is. How much pain can you take? Yeah.
Is it like Bad Blood by John Carreyrou about Elizabeth Holmes, that dreadful person?
Yeah. She's the, what's that?
Theranos.
She's right. She's the ex-billionaire. She won't be going on a spaceship anytime.
We had the investigative report. Remember when we went to Georgetown and he came visit us there? That was really, that was interesting. Yeah.
This is a much more elaborate story, a much bigger story, and I think more consequential too. I mean, we're still in this crisis, right? I mean, opioid epidemic is still raging away.
Yeah. Okay, speaking of epidemics, last time you were on, you told us you were dreading the onslaught of pandemic books. Has it started yet, or have you begun to hear about them? And if there was one author that would do a pandemic book, let's say fiction, who would you want it to be?
Oh gosh, yeah, the pandemic books have begun. I reviewed one a few weeks ago and I thought it was pretty dreary by a great writer named Jim Shepard.
What did you expect? Rebecca Sunnybook Sunnybook. I want a happy pandemic book.
Boy, I don't know what it will take, but it will take more than just everybody dying, you know, or everybody being stuck at home. I mean, it's got to be something fresh. I mean, we just lived through it. I don't want to read about that.
Right. Yeah. Okay, talk about Hidden Circle, Maggie Shipstead.
That's not quite a Great Circle.
Great Circle, sorry.
Great Circle. Yeah. Yeah, I think I love her book. She's written the third book. This Great Circle is a historical novel, kind of Amelia Earhart story about a lady pilot in the mid-20th century, a young girl, her orphaned, raised by her uncle in the woods, and she gets it in her mind that she's got to become a pilot and nothing will stop her, and she eventually does. And of course, this character is made up, but a lot of the other characters in the book are not made up, and it's just a great history of aviation, of exploration, about the adventure in the mid-20th century. I thought it was really cool. And there's a contemporary story about Hollywood that's also, you know, kind of fun and satirical.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, we have her on next week.
Oh, wonderful. Yep. Yeah, I love her. Yeah. I think she's just a wonderful woman. She writes, I mean, she takes too long between books. Tell her I want a book more often.
Got it. And no pandemic books. All right. So I see up in the upper right-hand corner of my screen, our featured author, Maroa, how are you?
Good. How are you? Can you hear me?
We can hear you. Nice to see you again.
Good to see you, Tori.
Maroa, say hi to David and Claude and Ron Charles. I think you know probably Ron Charles for sure. I don't know if you've ever met David Aldridge, who's famous. This is David.
Stop it. Stop it right now.
And Claude does all the important work.
I'm the one that's drinking. So.
Hello, everyone.
So I started at the top of the show, Maroa. You and I and P. Jelly Clark had a wonderful time during the Gaithersburg Book Festival. It was virtual, but we had a wonderful session talking about books, and it was so much fun. And so this, hopefully we can recreate some of the magic from that, because we had a really good time. And the Gaithersburg Book Festival people told me that not only was our segment great, it was better than Ron Charles, which is all I cared about. Ron, what did you do for the Gaithersburg Book Festival?
I was not in the Gaithersburg Book Festival this year. Sorry.
No wonder we were better than you.
Yeah.
Jeez. Okay. Ron, how are you doing? How's the end of the pandemic treating you?
Good. I'm glad that the weather's nice now and I'm enjoying the cicadas.
Yeah.
You know, what? The first.
You're enjoying the cicadas?
I am. It's special to me, David. And here's why.
Okay.
My first book was called Time of the Locust. So a motif in that book was the locus.
Yeah.
And then the new book, it took 17 years, just so happens. So, all you right. know, signs, omens, and bones.
Oh, God, I hate skittles.
You know, they are warning people not to spend too much time outside because it can impact your hearing.
And, oh.
Yeah. And this morning I went out to my car and there was a baby cicada on my car window and I squished it and I felt really good. I felt like
you can't squish them. That's not.
Yeah. There are no baby cicadas.
Yeah, well.
That's not how the life cycle works.
This is like if Martians invaded us, but they never fired a shot. They just kept hovering over us for weeks and months and just
deafening
us. Awful word. Just, we'll give you anything you want. Just stop making all this noise.
Here's what I can't figure out about cicadas. I promise, Maro, we're going to talk about your fabulous book, Creatures of Passage. So it's for the long time, it's been this 17-year cycle, right? So right. With global warming, why is that not impacted the 17 years? Because it's about when they come out of the ground, it's because the earth starts to warm up and it signals them to come out of the ground 17 years. And what the hell do they do in a leap year? What happens in a leap year? Is there like a meeting going, is it 17? Is it 16? Is it 18?
You do know that a leap year is just a day. It's not a leaping a year.
it's the mystery of nature, the mysteries of nature, Tori.
Speaking of mysteries, okay, we're going to talk about your book, but first let's talk about you, because not everybody knows you as well as I do now. You are a DMV native.
I am. I was born in D.C. at D.C. General.
Yeah.
And, you know, most of my family historically has been in Anacostia and Northeast.
What part of Northeast?
Over there by Benning Road.
Oh, sure.
David and
Claude. I grew up in Northeast, not Benning Road, off of South Dakota Avenue. So,
well, my father and his folks, they're all old Northeast residents and natives. He went to Roosevelt.
Yes, nobody ever knew.
You know, I went to his, I helped him celebrate his 50th reunion.
Mm-hmm.
There, I did a author visit. You know, it was real special. And they said, "Oh, a daughter has come back." that was kind of fun.
Yeah, that happens.
It does, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Time
back
flies.
To the old school, the old stomping, the old junior high school, the old elementary school. Yeah. Definitely.
Tell us about when you were a child, when you were five, what you wanted to be, what were you reading? Did you have authors that inspired you at a young age?
Yeah, I was an only child, so I had a lot of time to myself. I had a very vivid imagination, and I enjoyed, I wanted to be an astronaut.
Jeff Bezos. Ron is best friends with Jeff, so he can introduce you. You can be the first author in space.
Yeah, I hear he and his brothers going up, you know, so that's special. But yeah, and I my dad was the first one to introduce the wonder of books to me. He bought me a set, Beatrix Potter.
Book. Wonderful.
Peter Rabbit and all. So yeah. I started with that. Mm-hmm. And then I really went deep into The Hobbit, you know, when I was maybe eight and nine-ish. I had the book and record and all.
Nice.
So, you know, I too looked through the keyhole.
Yeah.
Very special.
Did you try to, when you were young, one of my sisters did this. They were same kind of thing, Beatrix Potter, not so much The Hobbit, but a lot of Beatrix Potter. And she tried to write her own versions. And they'd be different characters and different creatures and different stories, but she kind of mimicked the style. Did you do any of that when you were young?
You know, my dad said that I used to write little stories when I was like four and five and six, little scribble stories. Mm-hmm. I don't remember those stories. I remember the ones when I was maybe like 9 and 10, but he said, no, you did the, and he saved them. He sent them to me in a box, you know? So it was, it was little characters, Kiki and they had their little adventures. So yeah, nice. I guess it was always something in the background that I enjoyed.
Decades from now, you can send those to your archive somewhere when you donate all your letters and all your books and everything, that can be a part of it.
One day.
There you go. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about Creatures of Passage, which I've now read twice, and I've listened to it. And anybody listening to the show, you should buy the book and you should listen to the book, because Moroa does it, and it is beautiful. It's absolutely wonderful to listen to. Give us the thumbnail sketch of Creatures of Passage, because I couldn't do justice to it, but give us the thumbnail sketch of the plot.
It's tough, right? It's about a lot of things, but basically it's DC in the year of 1977. It's about a family in Anacostia, and our heroine is a taxi cab driver of sorts. She runs a sort of jitney service, ferrying lost souls, so to speak, around the city. So the culmination really begins when her great nephew comes to the door, who she hasn't seen in many years. She's estranged from, because she's estranged from his mother. And his mother has a dream, and the kid comes to tell him about this dream. And so the story then begins, the journey of the passengers getting into the car and what happens and how they're all linked, and they end up saving this boy, so to speak, because he witnesses something. Mm-hmm. He witnesses something at his school. And as we all know, children see things that they often don't understand, but it's a part of his reality. Uh-huh. In this school. And there's a visitor that he gets to know. He's an ancestor, and this person is he's the only one that can see this person. He's called the River Man. So, believe it or not, the characters do connect. Mm-hmm. It's a voyage through time. We extrapolate into the future, to present day, in many passages. So the reader knows what goes on later, many years later. And the characters don't in that period of time. And that gives a magical sense. It's a very, very much a magical realism story, written in the, I would say, the tradition of 100 Years of Solitude.
Uh-huh.
And Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to embarrass you for a second. And then I have a question. These are some of the things, Ron, The Washington Post has written about this wonderful book. Every once in a while, a novel is so compelling that it changes your sense of a place. Creatures of Passage is that book. Then the New York Times, Creatures of Passage resist comparison. It's reminiscent of Beloved as well as The Odyssey. That's some pretty good company. Clashing elements become in this cast a cohesive whole, telling us that this too is America. Comparisons to Toni Morrison's masterpiece Beloved always perk up our ears. How does it feel? Is it intimidating? Is it encouraging to have your name and your work and Toni Morrison mentioned simultaneously so often?
Well, it's, of course, in many ways, it's an honor. But I always looked at her as someone who I admired as an artist, who set the bar for artistry in storytelling. Uh-huh. And if I could do anything anywhere near what she did, it would be to aspire to keep that standard of art and storytelling very high. Uh-huh. And to do the stories of Washington, D.C., to do the stories of African Americans, to do the story of the United States justice by showing the complexity of those contexts.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's a little bit of an out-of-body experience, but there's only one Toni Morrison. Yeah. There's only one me. Mm-hmm. But I have been tremendously honored by that comparison. And I would say that if she were here today, she would expect me to continue on keeping that bar high in storytelling. Otherwise, you know, what's the point? If you're going to spend hundreds of pages on a book, it needs to be memorable. It needs to change people, maybe the way they look at things. It needs to stay with you, yeah, and maybe give you a sense of yourself and others.
Yeah.
That's Ron, what I try to do.
Let me bring Ron in this. Ron, you told us once, I think people drop 300 books off at the Washington Post every day trying to review, right?
Not quite that much, but yeah, it's more than 100 a day.
Okay. So probably less because thanks to the pandemic and the cicadas, so that's good. Mm-hmm. But you've heard about, and someone comes to you and says, there's this great book. It's this promising young author, these kinds of things. And you hear comparisons to Toni Morrison. What does it make you think? Does it make you intrigued? Does it make you go, oh, please?
Probably, oh, please, depending on who said that. But we did assign this book, and we assigned very few books out of the hundreds we get, the thousands we get every month. You know, we're only assigning scores of books, so it's a small fraction. So somebody let us know that this was a book we should pay attention to, and our reviewer loved it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
One of the things I love, I was about to say Toni, Marat, is that, and I'm a fan of Toni Morrison, and I recognize and appreciate her value, right, in the literary world.
Absolutely.
It's not always my cup of tea. One of the things you do in this book, and I'm at a loss for words. I'm always at a loss for words. There's magic, there's realism, and how you blend them. And I know the reach and the impact will go far beyond the DMV, but anybody who has lived in DC, again, David, Claude, natives, Ron's lived here for a long time. I've lived here for 40 years. You recognize those places and go, oh, she knows it. She gets Anacostia. She knows the significance of St. Elizabeth. There's realism. And then there's this magic. Process can be a boring word, but this is not boring at all. I want to know how you wrote the book. And was it, you know, you started at A and went to Z? Or did you say, I'm going to do the realistic parts first and then weave in the magic? How did you do that? Or was it just organic?
Very much organic, and it wasn't a linear process. The only linear part of it is I have a very creative side, and I have a very type A side. So when I get to the editing, then it's merciless type A, you know, symmetry, looking for symmetry. Yeah. But in the creation process, it's very much organic, like painting. You know, it's like making a big mural. But I mean, the book grew with me over the years. It grew with my family over the years. It grew with the city over the years. I mean, I think many of the reasons why you can recognize things in the book is because those things were very real to me. I mean, one of my aunts worked at St. Elizabeth for 20 years. You know, I was a White House intern. So I knew what that power dynamic felt like when you have a distance from, you know, you feel very distant from this great power when you're on the hill in Anacostia on the 4th of July for picnics. You know, I know what that looks like, what it feels like. It feels like an empire far, far away,
yeah.
You know, and I worked, you know, and over the years you work in different jobs, you know, so I know what the Pentagon feels like, you know, the sunless, moonless, airless rings. And that's why I could call it that, because that was my experience with it. So yeah, there's a lot of mixture of all together, magic and realism.
I was blown away by this book. It's just fantastic.
I didn't even know you read it. Thank you.
Yes, it is. And the reason why, you know why I was blown away? I'm going to tell you this. This is one of the few books, I can't even think of any offhand, that actually writes about Black people in D.C. It's just
right.
These are the people I grew up with. Like, there's a million books written about D.C., but it's always about Capitol Hill and the White House and lobbying and all that sort of thing.
Which
will be on Saturn, as far as I'm concerned. You know, growing up on 20th Street in Northeast, it has no connection to me whatsoever. But when, like, you're way too young to know about the Strip. How did you research that? I remember walking down 14th Street, walking past all those establishments when I was 19, 20 years old. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And I got them all. And I'm like, what did you do? How did you figure this out? Because you were like four when those places closed.
Copious research. One of the things, you know, I love research. I read everything. And I was always like that. So, you know, usually my writing process, I might be reading something totally different, seemingly unrelated, and I'll stop and say, oh, what about that? And I'll go and research about it. With the Strip, it was very, you know, there were a few things about it. But I tended to read people's experiences in, there's a blog called Ghosts of BC.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I read how people talked about what it was like when they were there, in addition to the literature that was already published about it. And then, you know, there's a strip in every era in every city. So
right.
Some of it is very special to DC. But yeah, you're right. You know, I wanted a book from a certain perspective that I didn't see as much. Of course, I've seen it in Edward P. Jones's Lost in the City, and I love that book just for the perspective that it gives.
Yeah.
But I really wanted to expand out to the other, the DMV dynamic, you know, and I just, DC is a very magical place in many ways. And there's a lot going on here besides intrigue and the government and CIA, you know, so, you know, you want to see the people who are here. And for me, it's also a disappearing Washington, you know, the Washington that I remember, or that my aunties, you know, those who have passed on, they used to tell me about Anacostia, their Eastern orchards, you know, my mom when she was little and her aunts, there were cherry trees and peach trees and all that kind of stuff. Now, I can't imagine that, but I would sit and listen to them tell me that. So I believe, okay, it was there. So. Yeah.
Well, they have those beautiful houses out on Branch Avenue, just gorgeous, with these rolling lawns. And you have no idea you're in Southeast D.C.
You would never know it, right?
It's beautiful. Yeah. It's gorgeous. So, I don't know. Yeah, so
my grandmother's garden.
It's all disappearing. All of it.
It's all disappearing. My grandmother's garden was like that. You know, it was like another world.
Yeah.
You know, there could be a shooting and then on the next block. But you didn't. You were literally in another world. So that's why you have those swirls of different, you know, worlds kind of coexisting together, and some never meet, you know?
Right.
Hey, Ron, didn't Creatures of Passage also get in the Post recently for books about DC that really give the essence of DC?
Yeah, the magazine asked a bunch of people all over the Post, I think all over the city, to name books about DC. Yeah, it was a great book.
I agree with David. There are so many that just classic, stupid Washington books. And all these politicians
official Washington
try to bribe Ron Charles into reviewing them. And this real, and I've lived here for a long time. I'm not a David Aldridge native, but I lived here for a long time. It is a wonderful city, and there are so many things going on, and people who have lives beyond Capitol Hill. And this really captures it. It really captures it. Please tell me somebody's doing a spectacular movie to which we'll be invited to the premiere.
I don't know. We'll see. You know, there's inquiries, but who knows? I don't know yet.
Talk about, just pick one or two of the characters in Creatures of Passage, maybe one to whom you relate the most, and tell us about them and how you develop them.
Ooh, that's such a toughie. People ask me that's tough because, you know, I admire and love all the characters, but you know, for different reasons, I guess in this time and age that I am now, I really love Osiris's character, because, you know, as you get older and your children go off to college, and, you know, every birthday is like a shocker, like, oh my God, you know, but he's already passed on and he's still got a new adventure, you know, and my father is also getting older, and we wonder, you know, sometimes we have these existential talks about, wow, you know, what could be next? You know, there's always, there's always another journey. So Osiris's character, I relate to. Nephthys Kenwell, who is the sinner, the taxi cab driver, she's special to me because that character was inspired by my grandmother. She was one of three black female cab drivers in the city. So she's very, that character is very special to me because I always wondered what it was like for my grandmother, who got into her car, where did they go, what lives did they live? And this book was a way for me to explore what it could have been.
Has your family responded to the book? I don't think we talked about this in the Gaithersburg Book Festival. Did they like it? Did they say, oh, that's me, or you didn't get that right? How have they responded to it?
Well, it's not a memoir, and so there weren't any specifics in there. But, you know, my family has always been, you know, hopping up and down and dancing in the streets about anything that I've had success, you know, success-wise for the book. So they're very proud. My dad talks about me. Others have come and told me, you know, your father talks about you all day long. You know, he's very proud. he's an educator. He was a college president for many years, so he's retired. So now he's got all of his time to really ponder the questions of the book. I think my family's most surprised and fascinated by the audiobook because they get to listen to, it's like another person, you know, Maroa Yejide is a different person to them. So they're like, wow, who's this? This is not baby girl. Who's this? You know? So it's, you know, it's a lot of fun.
I really recommend people listen to it as well as read it. And Ron, I'd love to get your thoughts on this. It is hard to read a book. It really is. And there are a handful of people who can do it well, a lot who do it badly. And it's so well done and it's so beautiful. But Ron, do you get dragged into that at all?
No, except that I know from authors that most of them do not record their own books because they are not good at it.
Yeah.
This must be a really, really special. I cannot wait to go track this down.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. You know, Audiophile magazine did a great review. You know, they really liked the audiobook. You know, I think for me, I'm a little odd in the sense that the character, I can hear the characters and the scenes in my head as I'm writing. So for me, it wasn't a leap at all to read the book because it's recording in my head anyway all this time. And it was always like that. So I know how the character would sound. I know the tone because it's kind of lived with me.
Yeah.
But and also what helped, in fairness, what helped, I think, a lot was I recorded the audiobook during the first week of January. So it was the shutdown of 2021, but a very bleak time still. So it was a real gift for me to go in this sound room and kind of escape the world for a few, you know, 5 hours a day and really, you know, close everything out. The irony is on the last day of recording, we finished at 3 and then our phones flashed with the Capitol building attack. So, you know, it was really telling in a way because, you know, the book was talking about kingdoms and how presidents act as kings and how states act as separate kingdoms. And and so even the sound engineer, you know, looked at me, he said, this is what you were just reading about.
Hey, when Oprah decides to make the movie, which will be invited to premiere, which character would you play?
Oh, me?
Yeah. Cameo. You could do a cameo. Maybe you're a passenger.
Okay. So if there was a cameo, it would probably be easiest for me to do Amber. Amber is the death witch, you know, the seer of death in the story. And I can really relate to her, of course, as a mom, because I'm always worried to death about my three sons, you know, what's going on, where are they, you know, what's happening. Mm-hmm. So it's very easy for me to draw on that well of angst and constant concern.
Yeah. Just a segue to me, because I can do that so easily. So today, talking to our 20-something daughter, David knows, Claude knows, and one of, you know, horrible things happened during the pandemic, horrible things. One of the best things for our family is our 320-somethings came home and lived with us for a big amount of time. And not what they wanted to do in their 20s, but my husband and I loved it. And she's taken a job in New Jersey, and she's moving out. And it was tough. Yeah. It was a little bit like when you send your kid off to college. Very draining for me because that's been a really nice part of that. And I know David feels exactly that way about his teenage boys.
Get out. Get out.
Okay. Back to the book. Okay, let's get you out with this, Moreau. What's next? What's in the hopper? Ron Charles can't wait to read the next one. What's next?
I want to go back and read this one. I feel like I really missed something.
Oh, Ron, it's terrific.
Well, you know, it's a great adventure again. You know, it's every book is a new mountain. So, you know, starting at the bottom of K2 again, we'll see, you know, where this book takes me. But, you know, again, it starts with an organic process. So, you know, we'll see. I don't know how long it'll take or how short it'll be. Time of the Locust.
Not 17 years. It's not.
No. Yeah. I mean, who knows? You know, Time of the Locust was, I guess that was 2.5 years it took to write that. And it'll just kind of depend on how the story unfolds, I think.
Well, you'll have to come back. Well,
this is wonderful. It's like an E.L. Doctorow book. It's like it's interwoven and all these characters know each other. It's fantastic. It's a great book.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much. That means a lot coming from me.
I want to read more about her. I want to read, you know, I found myself wanting to revisit time with the characters.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking about the taxi going, I've been in that car. I've been in that taxi. 3 o'clock in the morning going down to Half Street, you know, not on a straight night, by the way. It's fabulous. And if people as diverse as David Alders and Tori Clark can just fall in love with the book, that really says something. So Marilla, thank you so much for being with us. I hope to get to see you again soon. I hope
luck with everything. It's great. Good for you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You know, I think at a certain point, David and Claude, this show could just transition to chatter on books that became movies and Netflix series. Our authors.
That would be fine.
Pipeline.
I know. Now I have a career. I'm going to be a book reader. That's what I'm going to do the rest of my life. Just read other people's books. I think that's a good segue. It's a good off ramp for me.
Okay, Marilla, stay with us. I'm going to drag you into Deserted Island, shall we close out the show? But I've got to do a little housekeeping, and then we'll do Deserted Island, which is book recommendations. So the housekeeping is download us, follow us, review us on Apple iTunes. That really does help people. Thank you very much. Getting lots of recommendations of authors. We can't have them all on, but thank you to everybody who was talking to us about authors that we should have on the show. Hopefully they're all as talented as Marilla is. Mm-hmm. And then, as we were talking earlier, we are back next week and we've got Maggie Shipstead. Am I pronouncing that correctly, Ron?
Yes.
Okay. Maggie Shipstead, who is wonderful. And she is going to be back talking to us about Hidden Circle, which Ron talked about earlier. Ron, I think you said it was one of your number one books for the summer, right?
Yes. Great Circle, not Hidden. Great Circle.
Great Circle. Okay. I read that from the Washington Post. Great Circle. Okay. Kind of an Amelia Earhart thing. She's coming back with us next week, so thank you very much. So now, Deserted Island, since we are heading into the summer, and Ron and friends listed all these very high-minded, wonderful books that we should read, but there are beach reads. Mm-hmm. Vulture had a great piece on what a beach read really should be, and easy and somewhat trashy, and you feel a little bit guilty about reading it, but we need recommendations for beach reads. And I'll go first, because mine is probably the most mundane, but I really love John Grisham. I just love anything.
I know which one I was thinking about that book too.
Yes. Fully Met. I just love anything by John Grisham. And here's what happens when I read John Grisham. I read the first couple chapters and I think to myself, have I read this one already? and I get a little ticked off and then I keep reading and then I get completely engrossed with it and I love them. And that's my great beach read. Ron?
What's the name of the book?
Well, I just did Rooster Bar, which I really love. But really anything.
Got a new one, I think.
Fully Man, right?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. That's next. That's next week.
Trashy books? I don't read any trashy books.
There's nothing, you know, this is like comfort food. This is like, we're all coming out of the pandemic. Not that I go to the beach. I'm not a beach person. But you should allow yourself one guilty pleasure.
Jeez.
Guilty. So how about that? Yeah. Ron has no guilty pleasures.
I'm a sober-minded individual.
I'm guilty about the books I enjoy reading. I'm reading a book now that is so weird and so wonderful. I cannot wait to talk about it. Well, it's a queer version of The Great Gatsby by a Vietnamese woman, and I think it's just brilliant. It's by Nhi Vu.
Okay.
Called The Chosen and the Beautiful, and it follows along The Great Gatsby that we all know, we all read in high school, blah, blah, blah. But it is just not only magical, but actually magical. Like there are vampires and witches, and it is just remarkable. I can't get over it.
Okay, that's a good one. Your voice got very high when you were talking about that. I think
I'm very excited about it.
I mean, that's very high praise. David?
Yeah, I was thinking about Sully, which is the book by John Grisham, which I want to read because it is a fictional version of things that I know happen that I'm very familiar with in the basketball world. It's very familiar story, so I want to read his take on it. But I think probably if we go to the beach this summer, I'm going to take Stacey Abrams' book, While Justice Sleeps.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
It's doing great.
Yeah, it's doing great. I think it's top 10 still in New York Times. You know, and she's a, She's a really good writer.
She's a fabulous person.
Yeah, and as well as her other much more important work. But yeah, I want to read that just to see how she writes and thinks and researches things.
Yeah,
it's a Supreme Court mystery. So
years ago, before Stacey Abrams was really famous, I heard her on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which is, again, the third best podcast behind this one. And I didn't really know her or know of her. This was 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. And I'm listening to this person on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Queen. She is fabulous, right? So yeah. Then she becomes famous and this, and she has books. And so I dutifully sent off a little chatter on books. They laughed at me, absolutely laughed at me. But I'm gonna delay for just another 30 seconds so Moroa can think about a trashy beach read directly. Here's my John Grisham story, which is really a John Meacham story.
Okay.
So John Meacham spoke at our son Colin's commencement at Wake Forest 3 or 4 years ago, 9 million degrees out. It's like today. It was so hot, so hot. 9 million degrees. And the first thing John Meacham says when he's introduced is, I promise people we're going to be out of here in 14 minutes. Everyone, the crowd goes, wow. That's the clocks, those kinds of things. And he spent 10, maybe 11 of those 14 minutes talking about he is most often mistaken for John Grisham. Always mistaken for John Grisham. So much so that people come up to him with copies of John Grisham's books. And he used to, very politely point out, I'm not John Grisham. And he says, now he just signs the books, John Grisham, because
sure,
it makes
why not?
All right, bro, get down to our level. Trashy beach read. What would you recommend?
Get down to your level.
Yeah.
It's tough. I can't think, I'll be honest, I cannot think of a trashy. I don't read trashy. I can't think of a trashy book. Garbage in, garbage out. Never ask a literary fiction writer about a trashy book. And also it's subjective too. But
yes.
But I mean, if I was on a deserted island, selfishly, subjectively, I would only want to read like a classic or what I consider, a book that would take me to an adventure far, far away. So probably be something like Blood Meridian from Cormac McCarthy, because, it's very violent. It's kind of a Western, but you have the it's almost like a film, the way he describes the American West and what goes on. The devil is a character in the story. You get to meet the devil.
And you should read Outlawed.
How he tricks people.
Shouldn't Moreau read Outlawed by Anna North?
Oh, that's a wonderful book. You would enjoy it.
Yeah, it's a good book. You'd enjoy it, I think. It's a really good book.
Kind of a feminist, gay Jesse James, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Billy the Kid. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not Billy the Kid. I'm sorry, Sundance Kid. Sundance Kid.
Yeah, Butch Cassidy, Sundance Kid. Okay, that's great. Okay, we got to go. Moroa, thank you so much. Everyone should go out and buy Creatures of Passage at their favorite local independent bookstore and listen to it. Absolutely fabulous. David, thank you as ever.
Sure.
Ron Charles, thank you. Great to see you, my friends. Stay healthy. We'll see you again soon. Claude, thanks for making everything happen. Everybody, thank you for listening. Come back next week. It's Great Circle, Hidden Circle. It's a circle. We'll be back. Thanks, guys.
Great story.